Some of the almost 3,000 children separated from their families at our southern border are being resettled in Chicago-area facilities. Here's Senator Dick Durbin on ABC News.
There are some 2,300 or 2,400 children who have been separated from their parents as part of the zero-tolerance policy. The president has said he's changing that policy, but we're still waiting for clarity about what's going to happen to these children.
We talked to the only organization the government has tasked to advocate for these children based here in Illinois. And wolves are almost extinct in the U.S., but one farmer has been tracking a pack of canines for years. He's sure they're wolves. He's even got the Field Museum involved. And after 14 years, the Poster Children are back with a new album called Grand Bargain, a term familiar to those who follow state politics.
That phrase just always kind of grates on me. And when the Illinois budget crisis was happening, hearing that word grand bargain all the time, it just became something that when we recorded the song or started working on the song, it was just like, oh, this is something to yell. Grand bargain.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, when the president announced his executive order to end his administration's immigration policy of separating children from their parents at the border, many questions arose about how to reunite families that had already been separated. Those questions remain, but today we wanted to learn a little bit more about where children are being housed, both at the border and beyond, including right here in Illinois. To help us give us some more information and shed light on some of the bigger picture issues at play here when we're talking about immigrant children, I'm joined now by Kelly Albanick Cripps, an immigrant child rights fellow and staff attorney with the Young Center. The Young Center is the only organization in the country that the government has tapped to act as advocates for both unaccompanied minors and children being separated at the border from their parents when trying to enter the country. Kelly's on the line with me now from their offices on Chicago's South Side in Hyde Park. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Kelly, I think a lot of Americans have been wondering how children living at the border are doing. Are they safe? We've heard stories about kids in cages. And I wanted to just get to that first. I know that you need to be cautious about what you can share, but what can you tell us about what you know of the conditions of children at the border sites?
Well, you know, the question about whether the children are safe is a nuanced one to answer, because while they may be safe from the immediate physical harms that for many of them prompted their flight from their home countries, it's still a very difficult time for these children. They're in custody of the government. They're separated from their families. They're not sure when they're going to be released, to whom they're going to be released, if they're going to be allowed to stay here long term or return to a country from which they fled. So we see a great deal of anxiety and stress manifesting in these kids. And there's considerable evidence that the separation of children from parents can have lasting and significant effects on their development for years to come. So you know, we feel confident that, unfortunately, many of the children who have suffered this separation are going to be coping with the after effects of it for a long time into the future.
And how many facilities are there in Illinois? Where are they?
So there are 11 facilities for unaccompanied and separated immigrant children in the Chicagoland area. And I say unaccompanied and separated because I think that's an important nuance that sometimes gets lost here, is that these facilities were originally designed and created to take temporary custody of children who were legitimately unaccompanied when they came to the United States, who came here without a parent or guardian, and who would be in government custody until the government could identify a safe, secure home for the children to be released to. But now, when these children who arrive with their parents are being separated from their parents, they're essentially rendered unaccompanied, even though we know that they're not, that they were accompanied when they came. So they're being placed into this system that was designed for a different category of children and isn't quite set up to meet all of the needs for the separated children who are placed in these facilities. And I think we see that playing out with respect to the delays in reunifying these kids with the parents from whom they were separated.
And when you say they're not set up for that, can you give us an example of what you mean?
Sure. What I mean is that, so when the separated children are in these facilities, they have caseworkers who are attempting to reunify them with family members, but those caseworkers don't have a history of working with separated kids whose family members are in ICE custody right now, or are in U.S. Marshal custody if they're being prosecuted for illegal entry. So there isn't really an infrastructure in place. There aren't formal protocols in place for the agency officials within within the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who has custody of the kids, to be connecting with the points of contact at ICE and at the U.S. Marshals who have custody of the parents, and to work on reuniting those parents with their children.
That makes sense. Kelly, you said there's 11 facilities in Illinois. How do children end up here in the Midwest?
When the children are separated from their parents and rendered unaccompanied, within 72 hours, the government's obligated to place them in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is within the Department of Health and Human Services, the idea being that these facilities will meet the child welfare needs of the kids in their custody. And really, they're placed in these facilities based on where there's an open bed. Or in some cases, if a child has unique needs, there are certain facilities that are more equipped to handle kids who may have therapeutic or mental health needs, certain facilities that might be more appropriate for pregnant and parenting teens. But these children are placed in the facilities all around the country, really with no relationship to where their parents might be in custody or where they may have other families, family members in the country.
And do we have a sense of how many children there are in Illinois right now, both unaccompanied as well as separated, that are in these facilities? So you said there's 11.
Yeah, between the 11 facilities, there's capacity for roughly 600 kids right now. And that's, to be clear, that's 600 unaccompanied and separated children, the majority of which are going to be unaccompanied children.
I wonder if we could just talk about the unaccompanied children for a moment, because I think
Sure. We've
heard a lot about the children that were separated from their families. The unaccompanied children have been traditionally the bulk of children in these facilities. Can you explain a little bit more about how children end up here on their own? What are the common factors you see?
Sure. I mean, children come here on their own for a variety of reasons. Many of the kids that were appointed to serve may not have parents to care for them in home country, or may have maybe living with family members who they can't count on to keep them safe. So many of them come here on their own, seeking safety, seeking protection. They're fleeing domestic violence and abuse in the home, gang violence, transnational criminal organizations, and they're coming here seeking safety, and they make a long and perilous journey to a country where they hope things will work out for the best, so they don't really know. But what they do know is that their fates in the countries from which they're fleeing are certain to be grave and dangerous fates. So they come here seeking safety, and sometimes they may have family members in the United States with whom they're trying to reunify. Sometimes they don't. And so they arrive at the border and are placed in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which has an obligation to release them to a family member or close family friend without unnecessary delay if there's one available to receive the child.
My guest is Kelly Albanek Cribbs. She's an immigrant child rights fellow and staff attorney with the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, the only organization in the country the government has tapped to act as advocates for these children, as we're talking about with Kelly from her office on Chicago's South Side in Hyde Park. To just understand a little bit more, Kelly, when we say that you're advocates, mm-hmm. you're not their attorneys, right? What does it mean?
That's a great point. We are not, although many of us are attorneys, our staff is typically attorneys and social workers, we do not directly represent the children in their immigration proceedings. In the Chicagoland area, they have attorneys, typically from the National Immigrant Justice Center, who work with them and represent them in the removal proceedings. We are appointed as the independent child advocate, and our mandate is to represent the best interests of the child in our interactions with the many different agencies and individuals that have the capacity to make decisions about these kids' lives. So when we're appointed to a case, we go into the facilities where the kids are held. We meet with them on a weekly basis. We learn their stories, what it is they've been through, what it is they want for their future, and we assess what is in their best interest, what is necessary to ensure these children's safety and well-being. And then we advocate for that. We advocate for their best interests to any number of stakeholders. We could make a recommendation to an immigration judge about what should happen in a child's legal case. We'll make a recommendation to a representative from ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, about when a child should be released from detention or to whom a child should be released from detention. So we liaise with any number of agencies, consulates, ICE, the attorneys who are directly representing the children in their legal proceedings to ensure that what is in the best interest of the child is represented at all these points along the continuum of care where people are making decisions about these kids' lives.
And I wanted to point out that your work hasn't gone unnoticed. Recently, the Clooney Foundation just announced plans to give the Young Center $100,000. How are you all going to use that money?
Yeah, that was a really exciting development for us last week. And those funds are going to go directly towards a new project that we're going to be launching on specifically addressing the needs of separated children. We're going to be hiring a couple new attorneys to help work on these cases. Although the executive order, in theory, ends the current separation of parents from their children, we see that there's the long-term effects of the policy that was in place, they're not going to go away overnight, right? There's thousands of separated children and parents, and they're going to need services for many months to come, and it's going to take a long time to reunite these families. So we're launching a new project to address those needs and to also engage in some higher-level policy advocacy to make sure that as you know, folks on Capitol Hill are making policy about what happens to these families, that the importance of family unity and keeping families together is not lost or given short shrift.
I think there are a lot of people who want to try to figure out how they can help in this situation. What would you recommend they do?
You know, one thing that I've seen so many people doing of late, and I must say that the overwhelming public support for these kids and these families has really been stunning and sustaining to those of us who work with these kids and their families day in and day out. And I think it's so important for folks to continue to stay engaged, to stay educated about what the issues are, because the immigration system is so complicated and so multi-layered. It's really hard to understand what the real problems are and then how to best direct resources to solving those problems. So folks staying educated is key. As this issue continues to unfold in the coming weeks, I think we don't want to lose that national spotlight, which was clearly had an effect on the choices the government was making about how to handle this situation. So staying educated, staying engaged, continuing to talk to your friends, your neighbors, your family members about why they should also stay educated, engaged about this issue is crucial, as is continuing, I think, to support and to donate to the organizations on the ground that are actually working with these kids and their families and trying to get them back together.
When we think about immigration laws, specifically how our system treats children to that point, what do you think we could all understand better?
I think something that is so shocking to people who are just learning more about the immigration system is that our immigration system really doesn't treat children any differently than it treats adults. You know, at the Young Center, our mandate is to represent the best interest of the child. And this principle, this legal principle, the best interest of the child, is a foundational principle of U.S. law that is present in basically every court system that deals with kids, except for the immigration system. In our immigration system, the judges and different stakeholders who make decisions about these kids can make those decisions, and they're not required to ask what is necessary to safeguard the safety and the well-being of this child before me. So part of what we're trying to do is to change that over the long term, to help help implement reforms to the immigration system that would require decision makers to consider what is in the best interest of the child. Right now, kids are held to the same standards, the same burdens of proof as an adult would be. And I think what a lot of people don't understand, particularly with respect to this matter of the separated children, is that when the kids are separated from their parents and placed, you know, hundreds of miles across the country from the parent, the kids now have their own legal case, no matter their age. You know, a one-year-old can be named as a respondent in removal proceedings and appear before an immigration judge and have to go up against, in theory, a government attorney representing the Department of Homeland Security, which is kind of an absurdity. So I think when we talk about, you know, the important goals of long-term immigration reform, which I think everyone is in agreement that we desperately need, designing a system that recognizes that children are not adults in miniature. They are developmentally distinct distinct and important ways that need to be taken into consideration by our immigration system, and we need to provide them with extra protections because of those distinctions.
And Kelly, I just want to ask you one last question. Without asking you to comment on the politics of this issue, just thinking about the day-to-day of your work as we're thinking about how these policies are changing so quickly, how is the news affecting what you're able to do, especially now that you're branching into this new area of children being separated from parents who came with them?
So, I mean, honestly, at the Young Center, we're doing much of the same work that we've done for years in terms of trying to connect these kids with family members, to reach out to them, to facilitate a child's release from custody as quickly as possible. But, you know, the influx of kids in custody as a result of the zero tolerance policy that caused all these separations has made what was already an overburdened and under-resourced system even more so. And these cases are more complicated for us as an organization. Instead of just dealing with the stakeholders that affect the child's life, now we're also interacting with, liaising with, making recommendations to all the stakeholders and agencies that affect a parent's status here in the United States. So it's almost one of these separated child cases, almost twice as much work as one of our traditional cases on behalf of an unaccompanied child. So the workload has increased considerably, but the good news is that the attention to the work and the attention to these families has exploded so much that we're seeing an outpouring of support. We're getting more and more volunteers to work with our organization, more and more folks sending in charitable donations that allow us to expand our capacity to serve even more children and more families. And that's something that I can get pretty excited about.
That's Kelly Albanac-Cribbs with the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, speaking to us from their national office on Chicago's South Side in Hyde Park. Kelly, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I know you're really busy. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The poster children are back. The punk rock band is out with their first album in 14 years. Grand Bargain is a return to the stage for the band that flirted with reuniting a few years back. You might remember them for their tours all around the country in the 90s and early 2000s with albums like Daisy Chain Reaction. Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak are in studio with us here for an unplugged set. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to the 21st, guys.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you for having us.
And I should mention Grand Bargain is now out on Lotus Pool Records.
That's correct.
And you guys are touring again. So what brought you all back into the studio 14 years later?
Oh, that's my fault. So we re-released our second album, Daisy Chain Reaction, a few years ago. And the condition...
It was the 25th anniversary of Daisy Chain
Reaction.
That
was the last time you guys were on the 21st to talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. And we really, we love that record, right?
So, yeah, oh no, it's a great record, but I personally want to make new music too, so I don't want to be a nostalgia act. And so that was kind of the condition. If we were going to do old songs, we'd have to do some new songs too if we were going to play live again. And so and we started writing new songs and we started working on a new record.
And to be clear, it's not that you guys haven't been doing anything for the past 14 years. You've been leading very busy lives, also working on other projects, solo albums. But what was it really that 25th anniversary 2 years ago that where you all thought we want to bring the poster children back together for new work?
Yeah, and it's timing.
Our children can be left alone for small amounts of time without us worrying that they'll kill each other. Small amounts of time.
So it's not a coincidence that your oldest is 14 years old. Is that where we're at here?
It's your first record in 14 years. I wonder if that had anything to do with me.
So I was going to ask you guys just about the title track of Grand Bargain, which is a pretty searing, I think, indictment of America today politically. I wonder when you all wrote that.
That was one of the earlier songs, I think probably 2016. Did we write that?
Started with a bass part.
Well, it was basically during that time when the phrase, especially in Illinois, grand bargain was being rattled around a lot. And that phrase frustrates me because it doesn't feel like a bargain when people invoke grand bargain. It feels like things have gotten really bad and now you're going to have to make a lot of sacrifices because if not, everything's going to fall apart completely, right? It's not a compromise. It's not about a compromise. It's more about pushing things to a certain point where then everybody just has to give up and accept the worst possible solution as opposed to a bargain. And so that phrase just always kind of grates on me. And when the Illinois budget crisis was happening, well, I guess it's still happening, right? But that hearing that word grand bargain all the time, it just became something that was like a chant or and worked out, came out during when we recorded the song or started working on the song. It was just like, oh, this is something to yell, grand bargain. I think we've started realizing that a lot of this happens in cycles, and so sometimes artists are afraid to talk about current affairs because they feel like their music will become dated. But maybe the downside and upside of this is that, oh, no, sometimes they become dated, but then things come back or come back slightly different, right? History is more like echoes, right? And so the stuff becomes pertinent again, and so the grand bargain felt like it applied to so many situations.
We got half of the poster children in our performance studio here in Urbana with us, Rick and Rose. You're going to play an acoustic version from your new album. As we're talking about politics, I wonder, would you guys mind playing A Better Place?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. This is the first time we've ever performed acoustically in front of people.
It's just me.
On the air.
It's just me. You're only performing in front of me, really.
It's still first time.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah.
All of my friends think you are great. They think I made a big mistake. I don't know who they think they are. I don't know who they think I am. I'm in a much better place. Unfriended, I've gone face to face. See who is real to face. I'm in a much better place. I need my space. After 10 years, I need a break. I've lost all sense, I've lost all taste. My life with you has been a waste. And I love to be alone. And I need someone on one. But I can't be in this crowd. Don't wait up, I won't be
an acoustic version of Better Place. I've got two of the four-person punk rock band Poster Children in studio with me here. They're playing an acoustic set, so this is very different than what you normally hear. And from their new album that's just out now, Grand Bargain is out from Lotus Pool Records. They've got a couple performances this evening in Bloomington, tomorrow in Chicago. You said something, Rick, I wanted to go back to, which is artists and making political statements. And I wonder if you feel like America 2018 is a place where you feel like artists need to be making political statements. It certainly seems with this album, there's a lot of that in this album.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if all artists need to do it, but I feel like we had to. It's just something that we've done in the past. We've been political, and it felt like, honestly, the reason why we play our music and do this and why our fans like us is because we're kind of a release for them. And it's not even as much the idea of changing the world, but just having a voice and a way to get out your frustration with the current political state.
And we're teaching all the time. Somebody asked, are you teaching this summer? I said, I'm teaching all the time. You're teaching.
What our fans like is the fact that we give them a voice and they can, you know, come out to a show and scream along with us and get out their frustration.
What do your audiences look like now? I wonder what your audience looked like 2 years ago compared to what is this? Are these the same people that have been with you guys for you're nodding and saying yes?
They are. We were filling out. We were like sending out our records right the other day. We were like, and we noticed we know all the names of people. All the people. Yeah. Oh, there's this person. There's that person. We know everybody's names. We're all older and wiser. I was struck by that.
It's like a reunion, you know, like a high school reunion, except without all the kind of nervous, weird stuff.
Drama.
Yeah, drama. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
And what do your kids think about this?
They couldn't care less. We're not a video game, so.
I wanted to ask you, as parents, about a song on the album, Devil in the Gun. And this was released, actually. Did you guys release it? I'm sure you wrote it before, but the timing of it came out right after the shooting in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
And as parents of kids who were in school, I wonder if that was when you wrote that.
That's another old song. We wrote that in the summer or spring of 2016. And that's the frustrating thing about that song is, again, that idea of writing in a moment and then it becomes timeless. And that's the song out of all of them that to me frustrates me, that it's, I want these songs to age out in some ways. And so a song like Devil in the Gun, where you're reacting to maybe a current event and a current shooting, and then 2 years later, it's still relevant or more relevant.
It's not like 2 years later. It's like every month, every couple of weeks. In that song, we were playing that live, for one of the first times. We haven't played it live a lot, and it's really, I didn't realize how powerful it was either. I mean, even the music, you know, there's a chord change, and then there's a, you know, I can step on my make it louder pedal, and there's so many harmonics in the music, and I could feel so much anger I didn't even realize that I had while we were playing this. And then other people have commented, this song is really poignant. It's sad.
And of course, there's lots of other songs on this album that are not necessarily as political. Do you want to play something else?
Sure. Yeah. We can do Lucky Ones.
Trying to find the past in the mask in front of me. The hair and eyes don't match, but there's a trace left underneath. I always thought you were the lucky one. You always got the best to me. The halo made of gold above your head has turned to lead. I missed out on the crash, but I still see it in your face. I always thought you were the lucky one. Now I see that it was me, was me, was me, was me. Do 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 do. lucky ones. We lost it all, but still survive, 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 survive. Do, 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 do. Trying to find a path through the past in front of me.
Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak are two of the four-person poster children. We're getting a very rare acoustic set from this group. Thanks for being here. Their new album is called Grand Bargain. It's out now from Lotus Pool Records. As you guys are playing that, I was thinking about this. Is I was like, this is must be what evenings must be like in your household as you all are singing together, putting
very
your children to sleep,
looking at each other lovingly.
That's what we had a colleague who said that, who saw our like on Facebook and said, "Oh, your house looks wonderful. There's all sorts of creative stuff going on. You're all and it's I'm so jealous of your house." And it's like, and
it's constant screaming at the top of our lungs.
It's like any family,
things. It is like it's insane. And then there's violin practice, right? We'll sit
outside. Music.
Yeah, there's a lot of music out on the porch. We'll be playing violins and then screaming at each other. Sometimes Rick goes and hides in the basement.
That's right, yeah.
It's like a war.
So what's it going to be like now that you guys are, you're back, so you've got a couple, you're touring a little bit for this album.
Yeah.
What's that like to do that with a family?
We're going to find out. So, yeah, we're taking our kids with us this time.
So yeah, that'll be the first time we do that. So it'll be interesting. It's going to be a combination family vacation tour. We'll let you know.
And I was going to ask you guys also just about what it's like to release an album now in 2018, how different it is compared to the last Poster Children album, 14, just in terms of the industry.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, although what's interesting is kind of the indie rock world that we were part of and still are, I guess, was kind of, I would say, the foundation for what the music business is like now. I mean, honestly, when we first started out, it was you made cassettes, you found a friend down the road or in another town or in your town to put out your record. And then everything was done word of mouth through fanzines and through record stores and through other bands. And now that's kind of the way it works again, except we have the internet. And so the communication is easier, but that kind of grassroots network to me is what the music business is now. I mean, there's still major labels and major artists, but the reality is when you're a smaller active musician, it's all about networking. And we now have social networking and the internet to help facilitate that. So in a weird way, it's kind of the same, but then a little easier.
That's Rick Valentin of the Poster Children speaking to me in our performance studio recently. We'll be back with another song from the group after a quick break. Stay tuned to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Let's get back to our conversation with the poster children, Rick Valentin on guitar and Rose Marshak on bass.
So I wonder if you want to end by playing one of your old songs, maybe?
Sure.
And so we're talking nostalgia.
Was this song written at Allen Hall?
It's possible.
Yeah. Is this She Walks?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So this was in the movie Empire Records also?
Yeah. A few years after it came out. Yeah. But we wrote it. I'm trying to remember when we wrote the song. Probably 1988,
It would have been.
It's definitely a 30-year-old song.
She walks on hollow ground. I will echo every step. She walks on open hearts.
She walks on open hearts.
I will follow every step. Two eyes overflow. I never had. Two eyes overflowing. Two eyes overwhelming. The way that I feel. No one receives.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah.
Let's end today's show with a conversation about wolves. Hundreds of years ago, wolves roamed free over all what would become the United States, but for the past few decades, they've been driven nearly to extinction. So when Jay Smith noticed a pack of canines roaming his family farm near the western Illinois town of Industry, he started setting up cameras to try to get a closer look. Now he sent DNA samples to Chicago's Field Museum to confirm whether these animals are in fact wolves or coyotes or something entirely new. And he's on the line with us now, along with Tom Noski, who's the assistant collections manager for the Field Museum. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good Good morning, Jay. I wonder if we could start with you. As I mentioned, I understand that you saw these animals on the family farm that your wife's family has owned for a long time. Can you take us back to the moment when you saw them for the first time? When was that?
The first time that we actually, that I knew that they were there, we saw the tracks in the snow. And that would probably have been about 2011. And by November of 2013, then we started getting pictures, actual pictures of them. We had heard them, the red wolf howl is completely different than a coyote or a gray wolf. And so the research and the interest started at that point.
Were you interested in wolves prior to this?
Oh, yes. I've always had a connection with them, as pretty much a lot of people have. It's always been in everybody's mind, educationally, mythically, the fables and the tales and everything. My main concern was that we started discovering a lot of characteristics that were consistent with a red wolf, and they are considered endangered in the United States, period, almost extinct. And we realized that during our research that the sanctioned coyote hunts that go on daily here in Illinois, we were realizing that these wolves with red DNA in them, or red wolf DNA in them, as Ben Sack said in the article, were being shot in these coyote hunts, and there was pictures of these. And so this caused us great concern. And it advanced our research even, it expedited it, let's put it that way.
So your research, you've been sending DNA samples to the Chicago Field Museum. What does that entail?
Actually, we have found cadavers. We had Archie, who was the first one, and he got caught in a woven wire fence up in our northwest corner. And this is actually the sample that Ben Sachs received from me personally that had the red wolf DNA in it. And then, yes, and then two other cadavers were found near us, I'd say about a mile away and 4 miles away on some of the blacktops. They had been hit by cars, and they were very young. And so actually the samples are actual cadavers and skeletons that I delivered and helped get delivered to the Field Museum, to Tom there.
And Tom Noske is on the line with us, where he is not just as assistant collections manager, he's also chief, is it preparator? Is that your title, Tom, as well?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It means I prepare a lot of specimens for study, you know, cleaning skeletons and preparing skins, you know, for research, for study. Mm-hmm. So they're not really like taxidermy, but they're made to be measured and examined.
And so you've been looking at these DNA samples that Jay sent you. What have you found so far?
Well, we haven't started that process yet, and that's Kevin Feldheim, who's the head of our Pritzker lab, is going to be the person doing the actual DNA sequencing, and he's an expert on sharks, but he's been working with DNA for his whole career. So he's going to actually look at it. When we're just getting a few more specimens, samples in, well, they're specimens with tissue of coyotes and wolves and some other populations before we start it, so that we can have a look at this in a more comprehensive way, so we have things to compare it to.
Tom, how often do folks from the public contact the Field Museum? And certainly Jay has been at this for some time, being in contact with you and sending you things. Does this happen very often, that someone contacts the Field Museum and says, I've seen something that isn't normally what we see around Illinois?
We do get a lot. Lots of times, for example, people find bones or remains of things in their gardens. Frequently it turns out to be, you know, a raccoon, or maybe it's a cow bone from the last century. But occasionally there's something interesting, like a fossil remain of something. So we get a fairly regular people coming in with questions of all kinds.
What do you find interesting about what Jay has sent you?
Well, yeah, that's really interesting to us, because we don't know. and then the, you know, the DNA work will bear all this out. But in the eastern U.S. over the last 10 years or more, there's been a lot of things being discussed and found. And in the northeastern and east coast, there's something called a coy wolf, which is experts believe is a hybrid between coyotes and wolves in far eastern Canada. And I don't think this is what we have here. This was one of the first things that crossed my mind. And then there was also a lot of work done in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, looking at before DNA, looking at morphological characteristics of teeth and skulls, and they felt that these unusual characters that we're seeing, they felt those were signals from hybridization with feral dogs. So there's a lot of new technologies that we can use now to look more deeply into this and figure out what it is. And just to add to that, that wolves are every so often getting into Illinois. They're coming from the core population is in northern Minnesota, and they've populated some kind of satellite populations in Wisconsin, and those animals every so often come through the state, and they don't appear to settle because they need a food source that isn't here. They need large prey like bison and elk, or cows, and then they don't last very long. But real wolves do come through, and this has probably always happened, but they don't seem to be mixing with the population of the indigenous canids or the coyotes or whatever Jay has. And we feel like we can see that in the skeletons, that they're not mixes with timber wolves or gray wolves.
Jay, what makes you think that these are wolves?
All the biological, it's just basically going back, like Tom said, to actual eyes on biological science. The skeletal remains, Tom was talking about the skeletons. I think the most interesting thing that we discovered is Archie's paw, his foot bones. He's approximately 6 months old, yet he has a completely different structure to his foot than even a full-grown gray wolf would have. And these traits are things that we've never seen. And the height and the records, definitely the records. I'm kind of in awe that they were actually paying bounties in Schuyler County. They had wolf hunts in McDonough County in the late 1800s until up to 1945. And then any research or anything that was involved with wolves seemed to disappear, except for, thank goodness, for the Field Museum and Corey's 1911 report, who was the curator at that time. And so there's been this long history here. And so I feel that at some point in time after World War II, that we went kind of into the technological age too quick, and we lost the bioscience. And in the process, when they were looking at all these DNA samples, they forgot to look at the actual history, the written history. And that's the key thing right there.
And so you've been talking about the written history. I wanted to just ask you one last question. You've also set up cameras around the area to get images. What are you seeing?
I see these wolves constantly. They're very sociable animals. Their diets actually here, as Tom said, has been here for centuries. It's small game. It's rabbits. It's raccoons. It's field mice. Anything small. They're not large game animal hunters unless conditions prevail where they have to. Snow is on the ground. They can't find the smaller animals. They'll take down a small deer.
Wow. So you've seen that too.
I'm afraid
that we're out of time, but Tom, really quickly, when are we expecting to find out the DNA results of this? Do we have a time frame?
Once we submit all the samples, it will take a couple of weeks to get results. And so, I wanted to start this a little earlier, but I keep adding more samples to try to make it a more thorough geographic representation. Anyway, probably by August, let's say.
All right. Well, we will hopefully know by the end of the summer whether or not these are wolves or...
Plus we have Ben Sachs.
Okay.
Ben Sachs with the red DNA.
All right,
so,
great.
Yeah.
Well, we will have you guys back for the results. How about that? Jay Smith is a farmer, amateur naturalist from Industry, Illinois. Tom Noski with the Chicago Field Museum. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm afraid we're out of time. Tomorrow, I'm going to be speaking with Parker Palmer about his new book. It's about getting old and aging. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Penlilio is our intern. Technical direction engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron's our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.